Hello, I'm Joan. I'm a Canadian family physician who also works as a restorative medical educator, facilitator, and coach. I create spaces that rehumanize the work of healthcare. I'm creating this podcast to remind myself, as well as anyone else working in a helping profession, that when you are working and caring for your human patients, you are the other human in the room. Hello there, healthcare humans. Thank you so much for coming back for another episode of The Other Human in the Room. I feel delighted and excited to have this particular healthcare human on the podcast. Someone I didn't really know very well at all before this past year, and now I just am happy to be getting to know better. And Dale, you're one of these people where, like, I'm just so happy to know that you exist in medicine too, because it reminds me that there's all sorts of magical people in this healthcare thing, not all just like what, you know, people who are like buying into the dehumanized form of medicine. I feel like we can really resonate about more human forms of medicine. So I'm glad to have you here. Would you like to introduce yourself for the listeners?
Sure. Joan, thanks a lot for inviting me to have a chat with you today. This is going to be fun. So my name is Dale Gunter, and I live in Hamilton, Ontario. I am a family physician. I continue to do a little bit of family practice, but I'm on the tapering end of my career, and also have had a full life and full-time life of being part of McMaster University, with all the things that go with being on faculty and a professor in that setting. So I'm tapering off of that and discovering some new and wonderful things to get messed up in.
Such as?
Oh, gosh. Well, my favorite hobby has had to wind down now because of it becoming winter, but that is flying gliders. And so when I cut back a whole bunch of my work and retired from the university in July, the flying part of my life blossomed in a way that it hasn't really had a chance to that degree before. And so, and now I'm back to seeing what a routine is like in winter when there's less on my calendar, less calling my name, less time on email. And you know what? I suppose it's, what does it mean to be human in the world? Actually, I think that might be the way to describe it is, it feels like this amazing adventure of what does it mean to be human and really actually not have nearly the same identity attachment that I've had my whole life, and explore that side.
Well, I definitely want to ask follow-up questions about that. That sounds intriguing. And maybe a way to start asking that question is to hear a bit about what drew you towards medicine. Why did you decide that was a career path for you to begin with?
Yeah, I would say I spent most of my years before medicine being drawn away from medicine.
I relate to that.
Tell me more. That's good. I had a hunch you did, but I wouldn't have been able to say it quite so clearly for you. But yes, for me, my father was an internist and an academic, and I would say very focused, very productive. So he had a life that was really totally consumed by his work, and I know he was very good at it, and I felt quite proud of him, but I felt pretty strongly that that wasn't the life that I wanted to have. I didn't want to have that kind of singular focus, and I wanted to do a whole variety of things. Actually, it was very hard to decide, you know, what to go into and so on, but as often happens, one decision after another, eventually ruled out some other directions that I thought might be good, until finally it was sort of this idea of, well, the combination of human beings and science really is important to me, and I guess that's called medicine. So off I went to write some of those silly exams and throw in some of those silly applications and go through the t steps and went into medicine.
That's great. Did you have a sense, was your journey to choosing your specialty one that was very clear, or did you consider different kinds of specialties besides family medicine?
I definitely was not clear. In fact, I would say I had heard a lot of narrative in the household that was sort of like family doctors and emergency doctors are terrible people, and they just are not what they need to be. Internists are everything. So, that was the narrative. So I really didn't have a glowing, wonderful picture of being a family doctor. But I think once I went through, in the day we had the option to do a 1 year rotating internship. So I did that after med school. I really wanted to do that get out and get exploring thing. And then I did come back to a second year because all of Canada was requ starting to require it. But my second year, I ended up doing in internal medicine mainly because I felt like I had already been practicing family medicine in a sense. And then I grandfathered into the CCFP exams and things. And so finally came out a true family doctor. And I think, by that time, really felt like I had explored the possibilities and I was quite committed to this way of practicing.
And I'm aware at least a bit. So have you always had like an outpatient practice that is your practice, or have, I know you've also done some other things, like I think shelter health, right? Or like some other bits and pieces. Like, what's your career look like in
Yeah,
that
my
regard?
first 10 years were pretty varied. I had initially done remote northern medicine. I was in Churchill, Manitoba, and Iqaluit, Baffin Island, and a total of about 2 years in that. I then had about 6 years in a new community health center in Calgary, and that was, a pretty dedicated sort of family practice setting. Did a bit of hospitalist in parallel, but mostly it was that place. And then when I moved to Hamilton, I was fully immersed in full on full time practice, and have had a practice ever since. That was in 99. I have, yeah, the shelter health work or shelter health network, which a group of us formed in 2008, is definitely less a continuity practice, but it's not exclusively episodic. It's the people that come there, many decide that that is going to be their continuity place, but it's, yeah, it's not the same as having, 1,000 patients on your roster and knowing that you're it for them 24/7.
And so I know, like, we first connected really after you'd listened to some of the podcasts because of a mutual colleague suggesting, and that you had resonated with the ideas that some of the ways that we are trained or are taught to treat each other, treat ourselves, aren't fully human centered. I'm curious, as you like reflect back, whether through training and in practice, did you notice certain inhuman stories that were common for you, ones that ended up grating against and having to be released at some point?
Yeah, there definitely were the so I think there was certainly some, show, I guess we could call them inhuman stories about how much time should be spent both preparing for and working in this line of work. I think there were some stories that were about availability to others, especially to patients, but not necessarily only patients, and sort of the degree of I guess it's sort of a morality, more how it is a moral thing to be imminently available. I think there was something about being able to carry very heavy stories and lives along in a day and have them start to layer in on top of each other, but just keep going and leave this one, knock on the next door, walk in and layer in another one, and the next door, layer in another one. So yeah, and there was certainly something about not making mistakes, that mistakes should not be made. So those are some of them that come to mind right off.
Yeah, those are some good heavy hitters. And maybe each of those would have had their own individual story arc, if you will. But I'm curious, did you have, say, sort of a one or maybe multiple points of, say, burnout with these stories, or like moments that made you recognize that you might have to release some of those stories to stay in medicine? Whether it looked like burnout or something else, you know?
Yeah, I think when I started working at McMaster, part of the decision to do that was that it felt like I would be sharing the load a little bit more, would be part of a larger team, a larger group of people who were sort of looking out for each other. Supporting each other. I felt like I had been, more isolated f for the most part in the community health center that I'd been working in. So there was a definitely a point there of saying I need to have a little bit more room to breathe, and maybe a bit more room to share a bit of what I'm going through from day to day. And it did a lot of that actually. It was wonderful to be in what we called a team room, during a clinic day, and come out from seeing a patient and two or three colleagues and maybe two or three learners are sitting in the same room, and there might be something I really felt like I had to unload from what just happened. And people were very generous with their ears and willing to listen and maybe offer an idea or two that might help me make a little bit more sense of it. So there that sort of yeah, that sort of support circle, I suppose, became quite important. There then got to be a new kind of narrative in academic medicine, which was, oh, well, guess what? Not only do you need to see patients and have learners, but there are probably some committees and some research projects and some ways of being productive, which, I chose. It was my choice. No one else told me I had to do that, but that narrative was really hard to sort through. Sort of, well, how much do I have to do, and how far do I have to go, and how much can I handle? So I think in the early years in academia, on the one hand, the clinical work felt like it was really becoming a bit more manageable. The other stuff that was added in took me a while to figure out. But your question, I think, was there a burnout? There was definitely a stage where I thought so the for me, what felt like a big turning point was starting to realize I had done enough clinical medicine that I was beginning to realize most people who were coming in to see me were giving their suffering a name, and it's the name they thought that, it's a name they understood and they thought I would understand. So it would be like, it hurts. I have pain, or I'm depressed, or I can barely walk. Anyway, so they would use those kinds of terms, and I would get all wound up in trying to figure that out from a through a physical assessment lens, and maybe a psychological assessment lens. But I began to think there is something else that is all about how a person is connects to themselves and connects to others in their life and connects to their sense of purpose and meaning that's actually at the root of much of this. And I'll just wrap that up in this word that's so difficult, which is spiritual. So to me, the way I made sense of that was there are spiritual issues going on for people, and I don't have a language for it. I don't have a way of thinking about this, but it feels like that's what they're really coming with. They might not know it that way, they might not see it that way, and they certainly don't have much idea of what to do with that. I think what it started was an adventure in figuring out how to have compassion when people are coming with these things, but not feel like I had to fix or solve or even diagnose necessarily, that there was a way of being with people in a with compassion that would actually be easier for me. It would, in the sense that their heavy energy could flow through me. It didn't have to stop in me, and I didn't have to carry it. And I could then continue to be with the people that I really felt I wanted to be with and spend time with. So.
Oh my gosh. You just said a bunch of really beautiful things just there. That was like one of the core things as you know, I'd wanted to talk to you about was, yeah, this term spirituality, like you say, can have edges and stickiness because of, well, like any big abstract term, it's used in a million different ways. And I've been really intrigued to hear a bit about how you have explored spirituality, I mean, in your personal life, but also like how considering your relationships with your patients through the lens of spiritual suffering at sometimes, how that has eased things. So as you've already said, in some ways it makes it easier. You know, maybe you work through the list and you're like, I think this one isn't physical or psychological. It's more spiritual. Yeah, I'd be curious to hear more, like whatever you want to say is either like what traditions you was it that you noticed the spiritual suffering first and then found traditions that were helpful for you, or was it that personal exploration of spiritual traditions then you started to notice it in the patient room, you know what I mean, or both? What was that journey like for you?
I'll go back to I was raised in a very sort of conservative religious environment, which was Mennonite, and I would say I had a lot of time in church. I had a lot of time learning Bible stuff.
Also, really.
So that was sort of my the base, I guess, from which I moved, and that was my starting point. I sort of came to spirituality through a religious framework, and that I think that probably slowed down actually the exploration of, a real sense of spirituality. But I don't think it has to. But for me, there was a yeah, there was a then a sort of leaving that behind and having nothing else that really filled its place. And so there were a few years in there where it was just sort of, so I don't have a framework, I don't have a language, I don't have a structure. So then what is what else is there in under the umbrella of spirituality that you could access with without saying you're without diving back into sort of a religious framework. And so I really began to explore what it would mean to learn about that. And I had a starting point, as so often happens. I had a few friends who had been on a similar path, and one of the areas that sounded very appealing to me was an ancient tradition, which some call spiritual accompaniment, some call spiritual direction. Really, pretty much every major religion has its discipline of spiritual accompaniment. And if you think the word spiritual is hard to define, the word spiritual accompaniment is really hard to define. But one of the ones that I like the most is that it's like midwifery, and that is that it is giving birth, helping a person give birth to their own story.
Ah, beautiful.
And so it's ways of another really great description, I think, is helping a person to have an important conversation with themselves. And the third one I'll offer is that it is a way for a person to find the path to their own heart. So, it is complete in the setting that I ended up exploring some training. I did some specific training with a group that does spiritual accompaniment. It was very not religiously based. It's religiously open because religion has a place in spirituality. But it's not it's not it, there are many who do this program without a religious background and with no intention to develop a religious background. And so a lot of it became about my own personal practices. What I do to be able to breathe, what I do to be able to hear not only my intellect, but also my heart and my gut. What I do to be able to trust my body. And this is one of the pieces when I first listened to your podcasts that I thought, oh my goodness, she's claiming the body for this work. This is awesome. My body matters too when I'm in the room with a patient. My body has something to tell me. And I was floored by how what that opened up for me who resides so much in the head, and to begin to say, well, there are three centers to knowing head, heart, and gut, and these are all things that I can develop and strengthen and call upon for my wisdom.
I would love to hear, like, whether you have specific examples or just generally, in particular, the distinction between heart and gut. I would love to hear how that shows up for you, even now, as you say, you're practicing medicine, though tapering out, and certainly when you were in the midst of practicing medicine more fully. How would you notice the head, the heart, the gut coming up in connection with patients? And, I would imagine at times they would be in conflict, or, like how did that conversation go with all of those centers of knowing?
Yeah, well, the head part is to me is the part that wants to understand things, have information. The head wants to have information, and the head wants to fix. So I think when I notice that I'm getting in, and that's often, I think, to me, that's often the most exhausting. It's because there's another narrative in there, which is that, and I think I listed that as one of them, but the narrative, the non-human narrative, which is, I am here to fix you.
Yes. Oh, very much,
And
yeah.
if I don't fix you, I have probably failed. It's it.
Oh, so
So
relatable.
there's so much to that. And so that was mostly my mode prior to exploring these other channels. I think when I'm aware of my body, I am, it's giving me information about the effect this person is having on me, the effect their story is having on me. And I can start to say, I wonder what they're evoking in me, what is going on with that? And how can I hold that? How can I hold it differently? How can I get rid of this knot that's here right now? How can I welcome whatever is coming my way and let it continue to move instead of get stuck in me? So there's that about the body. And I actually think that if I'm doing my own body work while sitting with someone, they become aware of it. I don't mean, oh, they see me do a funny movement or anything like that, but I think they become aware of the way energy is moving and the way I'm settled. And I think it has an impact just without me even speaking anything. I think it has an impact on somebody and their comfort with being there, their comfort in saying what they want to be able to say, that kind of thing. So, we often, I think, use the term deep listening or intense listening or active listening or something like that, almost as if what it means is that we're trying to really open our ears, like, and I don't think that's it. Like, I think what it is that we're aware of what's happening to us through this story, and we are, I mean, the word I guess that really encapsulates the whole thing is present, being present, and being present in all of these centers of our knowing. Heart, for me, is a little harder to talk about because I think heart is. My favorite way of thinking about heart is that it wraps up everything. And the heart as an organ, as a physical organ, is astounding. And the more I study what is happening with heart and how much neuronal activity there is in the heart, and that there is even intelligence, there are intelligence neurons in the heart. And that it's getting information from gut, and it's getting information from head, and it's busy assessing things. I find it harder. I find that the hardest one to sort of be having an awareness of, especially since we have no feeling of the heart, right? We have visceral feeling of, well, neck, head, and abdomen, but. But it's a problem if you're feeling your heart.
Yeah, the heart's saying, help me if you're feeling. I guess other than you can sense your pulse a little bit, but maybe that's a bit separate. Yeah. That's a powerful way to describe. I was curious because I've noticed, first of all, I'm going to be like, my heart, my gut, how they speak to each other. And I have noticed how much, more relaxing and more surprising my creativity can be, like how creative my approaches can be when I have not dismissed and rejected my head. My head's very helpful. There are things that can be fixed, like, I don't know, hinges on, we can screw the hinge back on the door or whatever. Like, there are things that are useful in that realm. But the more I've de-emphasized and now are exploring like emotion and sort of body wisdom, it's really shifted Yes, the tone of my conversations with my patients, like even the calmer presence, like you said, like I relate to feeling like patients can sense the difference. But also, I've noticed like my gut has some interesting ideas about what to do next, especially in those sort of complex, probably spiritually affiliated medical cases. Have you noticed a similar thing, or like, have you noticed, say, like your management plans shifted when you started including your heart and your gut in the conversation?
Yes, definitely. I feel like I'm a much less interesting teacher now because I don't go through lists and algorithms very much now. I had to learn them at one point, and I think you are right on. You hit the nail on the head, that we need them all. And I guess I would just say our culture and probably our profession are very skewed in general towards head and head practice. And in fact, many times I've been suspicious about things like what I'm saying right now, right? That there's a oh, you can't trust that. Oh, that's not rational. That's not
What's the evidence for that?
right,
That kind of
right.
thing,
And so we. We're suspicious of giving ourselves, even honoring that in ourselves, I suppose. So your question was whether that changes the kind of diagnosis and things, and it does. I don't think the medical side, the rational side, goes away. And in fact, sometimes, I mean, it really has to be absolutely the priority. If there's something acute, let's get on with the head. Let's go there and
Yeah,
let's do this
100%.
thing. So much of what we deal with in family medicine, though, is not acute. And there really is time. And so I guess that's the one thing I would say is that it makes me feel like I can actually give things time and space. And in fact, they probably require time and space in order to for real healing to happen. And so to say, that patient left today without an answer and all of that, it's like, that's okay. Hopefully, what they left with was seeing the situation a little differently from when they came in, and maybe even feeling like they have an ally, and maybe feeling like it isn't quite as urgent now as it felt like when they were coming in. So, maybe that's all for today, and then that's okay. And I think that takes a while to get used to. I don't. Early in our careers, I think that feels like a real cop out. It's, oh, I didn't do enough. I didn't do enough.
So true. And then we realize in some cases you couldn't possibly ever do enough in the sense that you're just doing a bunch of things, but it's actually very much not hitting the nail on the head because we might be in a different realm, right? I was curious to circle back to the question of identity, in that you had said, well, at this point, as you're tapering down your dose of medicine in your life. And you're noticing less identity attachments. I was curious if you've noticed that your sense of identity has shifted over your years practicing medicine. Like even from the start, like you were offered an identity you could have kept for yourself, which is family physicians are inferior to internal medicine. And did that get internalized? And so like did you notice those sorts of identities having to shift and at times chafe against in your day-to-day life?
So I think the initial, as I said, I went did a rotating internship, and then a few years later did a second year in internal medicine, and there was definitely a sense of expectation, I think, from peers and so on, that that would continue on and I would finish internal medicine, even though I'd started in order to qualify for family medicine. So there's no doubt that there was a sense of choosing family medicine is lesser, and if I don't continue on and finish this fellowship or this residency, I should say, it will be another cop out. I ditched early, and real medicine, it's only 3 more years away, so why don't you just keep going and do those other 3 years? So that was there. It did chafe. And I think that the identity of family doctor only really felt like it fit really well once I started to realize how family medicine is some of the glue in between what all goes on with the specialists and just how important our patients find us when they're desperately trying not to go to a specialist. They really want us to keep working with it until we've absolutely tried everything we could, or they come back from the hospital and they need us to help make sense of what all happened and what's going to be next. And all of that I started to realize is so essential, and that it all began to settle in, and the chafing of family medicine versus all the rest became a non-issue. It was also very interesting how that sorted out with between me and my father, because I think he began to see some of that as well. And as I would tell stories of my typical day or typical week, or he would have his own health troubles or his health troubles of his friends, and I would offer my family medicine slant on that, and it was like, oh, he was very taken by that. Yes, that would be good, wouldn't it? That would be good. So that helped, feeling like it began to be valued as well by him.
I wonder other identities as well. Like, for example, as you started, because you had mentioned as you were growing in this sort of exploring different spiritual practices and what spirituality meant for you and practicing some amount of that in a room with a patient, was that something that you felt comfortable sharing with your peers? And so that kind of identity, or I don't know, were there pieces of yourself that felt harder to be authentically you within the container and profession of doctor, including, say, that spiritual one, knowing that, like you'd said earlier in your career, you'd been like, that's not rational, right? So, did you have trouble sort of fully owning said identities, or like, what was that journey like for you?
Absolutely. I did. I guess I had my own unease. Just as you and I have already bantered about some of the difficulties with the term spiritual. But I think even if you don't use it and you start unpacking what is it that we're actually doing and what is it that head, heart, and gut and all of these different things, I still am. Not at ease with I guess declaring that. Maybe I even still haven't found quite the words that I want to be using, although it's getting better and better over time, I think. It's easier. But well, in a couple ways, I think I'm evolving and more able to find the words that I want and that I think will work with my peers. But I also think the world is changing a bit. I think the
Totally.
language is out there so much more than it was even 20 years ago, and it's everywhere. It's on our television shows, and it's on the radio, and it's on the morning show, and everybody's breathing and they're having time outs, and they're doing, it's like, oh gosh, it's so cool. It's mainstream. So, who doesn't have a meditation practice these days, you know?
You at least have an app on your phone that you
Yeah,
use
that's
from time
right.
to
Yeah. And
time.
you won't laugh at somebody when they say they do it because
Yeah,
you
totally.
know, whereas at one time you might have. And it goes beyond mindfulness, you know, and I mean that was a beautiful sort of, I think, start for many of us was to was all the wonderful ways that mindfulness became accessible and well taught. And I mean, there's an interesting example of what really started out as a spiritual practice and became a owned by medical, evidence-based, you know, protocol-driven stuff, which I don't have any issue with. But it was, I think it was pretty intentional and pretty well thought through, you know, to get mindfulness practice to be something that we could adopt into our medical practices and things like that. So,
Well, I know at least definitely one way that I know that you express this spiritual part of you is in your role as like, is it called, what is it actually called? Director of Faculty Experience or was it something like
yeah,
that?
faculty experience director, yes.
Okay, I flip-flopped it because that's how we came into contact. Like, you very generously invited me to give a keynote at a retreat this past year that was just like low-key life-changing for me. That was sort of all about this stuff. And then also invited someone we're a mutual fan of the poet and theologian Padraig O Tuama to come and do this workshop for the department that we're both a part of. And I think all of that is a lovely way to do it too. Maybe it's less about like what you say you're doing, but sometimes the experiences you're facilitating for others so they can discover for themselves, and they don't even have to call it spirituality. You know what I mean? But like they get to be in a container where they consider things other than the guidelines and algorithms for a minute.
Yeah, that's true. It is it's a wonderful role in that sense that I think there are a variety of opportunities to sort of drop in some of the ways of being, some of the practices, even the ways of thinking about things. I mean, your keynote a year and a half or so ago to me was exactly, you know, that was exactly what I would say was a, you know, a spiritual eye opener. And I can't even remember if you used the term spiritual except to say that you didn't want to use the term spiritual, but you know, it was so being human, here was my huge intrigue with listening to your first few podcasts is it felt to me like you had come upon a language that I was still struggling to find. And so being human, that's it. That's it, being human. And that's easy, you know, easy for people to hear. It's easy to access. It felt to me, you're younger than me, and it felt to me like, oh, maybe your generation will be able to do this, you know, in a much less burdened way than my generation has. And it was so great. It was so affirming. And it made me want to learn as much as I could from you because I thought, yeah, I'd like to adopt some of that dictionary and, you know, that way of thinking of things. So yeah.
Well, I also look forward to future opportunities to learn from you and with you. Like I know you do these like silent, sometimes you host these silent retreats, contemplative retreats and things. They sound really incredible. And yeah, I just always like one way I say it is like, oh my gosh, there's so many. I think actually every human is magic for sure. And there's some that through trials and tribulations and luck or whatever, their magic has come closer to the surface. And I would say that you are definitely one of those people, and that you're open to speaking about things that are not like the normative, what's the budget, what's the algorithm, what's the whatever, you know? And so I just so appreciate the fact that we our paths have crossed and we've been able to do such wonderful things together already, and that you've had this time to give to us. I'm mindful of the time. I think I have an alarm that's going to go off in a little bit, so I'm going to turn it off because instead my brain set an alarm. I was wondering, just thinking about the folks who are listening to this podcast, and they may be earlier on in their journey, especially maybe someone who's feeling some of that sort of overwhelm of thinking they have to be a fixer, thinking they have to be everything for their patients, or they're at the stage where they're feeling just quite disillusioned about medicine. I hear a lot, I'm sure you do from colleagues, of like, it's not how it used to be. Everything's terrible. Everything is falling apart. Like, you know, everyone's sort of maybe making an exit plan of spirit or of body. What words of encouragement or wisdom or validation or whatever would you want to share with those listening who are struggling with the inhuman aspects of our profession?
Well, yeah. What would I distill out? You know, I one of the biggest lessons that I have spent probably a couple of decades trying to master, or trying to improve at least, is figuring out what is my responsibility and what is not. And I think I began to realize early on that so much of the dehumanizing experience I was having was actually stuff that was my responsibility. I was either overpacking my calendar, or I was taking to heart some offhanded comment that came from a colleague, and taking it far too seriously, or externalizing the cause of my unrest to, you know, the system or other people, when it felt like it really felt like I had a choice in almost, well, probably all of this. I have a choice. And that's another piece that I think you have described quite well in some of your earlier podcasts. So I think recognizing that we have agency, and always, always, always being alert to what is mine and what I might be able to choose somewhat differently in order to be more human. In order to be more human, it really comes to that. And so I said I retired from the university in July, but I have had many retirements over the last 30 years, and all kinds of little pieces of things that, well, you know, I did that. It needs to end now. It needs to end. And sometimes, most of the time, that was to do with work things, I think, but sometimes it was to do with things in personal life as well. And so I think a whole series of mini retirements is not a bad idea. And it doesn't mean that you might not fill it with anything else. So hopefully sometimes you don't, but sometimes you do, and it's something that makes a lot more sense, or it's the right thing for now. That was the right thing then, or you thought that was the right thing then, and now it's not anymore. So, and I think actually, we have quite a bit of flexibility in our profession. There's a lot of professions that would have a lot less flexibility to do that than we do. You know, just imagine how many choices you can make for yourself as a teacher. I think that would be one that would be, you know, probably one of the hardest in that sense. So each time there's probably something that we're going to grieve as well. And if our anticipated grief is what's holding us back, that's not a good reason to be held back. That means you love something about it, and you can continue to love that later, even when you're not in it.
Yes. In fact, don't wait till you stop loving it. Which could happen if you hold on too long, right?
Yes, yes. Which was part of the reason for my choosing when it was time to sort of do that mostly retirement in July. So yeah. So that would be one. I think maybe one other is just to develop your own awareness of what gives you your own most humanity and make sure that you're not crowding that out or you're able to do that. So whatever what that is, there was a point where I actually had to have a big talk with myself about flying gliders because it felt like the stupidest thing to be doing, in the sense that it was super fun. It did nothing for anyone. There were no volunteer points. There was nothing to make the world a better place by me going all by myself in this thing with wings and bouncing around in the clouds.
Oh, it sounds
And so,
essential because it's not essential other than that you're
that's
doing it. I think it that makes it the most essential.
right.
Oh, it sounds
Yeah, so there
wonderful.
was a point where the permission there I really had to work on the permission, and then I've really never turned back, and I've just said, you know what? I think I am a better person in the rest of my life when I have had some time to do this. And actually, there are some really great interactions that happen out there too. Like, there are young kids and old guys that are all out there excited about this sport, and my goodness, maybe I can have, some impact there. So anyway, yeah, finding whatever that is, and if it's very structured or very unstructured or whatever, it just is.
Do you like Wicked? Have you seen the movie or do you know the stage
I
or
have not yet, no, but
but
have
you're
to.
aware of the content? I mean, I would just feel like I'd be constantly singing Defying Gravity up in the air 'cause I'm like, "I'm flying. It's happening."
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's so cool. Well, thank you so much for sharing just the surface of your story and your wisdom. I feel like so many little nuggets that I took from our conversation, including that the three centers of knowing. I'm sure I've heard that phrase before, but I like being reminded again of, yes, like each have their own center of knowledge and what's it like to weave between them. So thank you for that and everything else you shared. Do you have like a public presence, like website and stuff, or not really? Do you want people to contact
Oh,
you? It's
maybe
fine if they don't.
that's
Oh,
the
yes. Okay.
third thing. Zero social.
No social. That is wisdom. So don't try and find Dale. He's not available. Don't follow him.
At this point, I just think I feel I'm way too special as a zero social person that I could never change it.
Yes.
But I do feel like I don't really know how to fit it into my life at this point. So.
It's fair. It is. I think it's net not super positive for sure. All right. Well, thank you so much. And for everyone listening, yeah, I hope you were able to just absorb even just a little bit of like the goodness that Dale just offered all of us and consider what your one thing is that's of use to no one but yourself. That's one of my favorite things to invite people to consider. And otherwise, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Jim.
I would love to take this work deeper with you. Visit joanchanmd.com today and discover my growing menu of options for restorative medical education to suit your learning needs. I offer one-on-one coaching, customized workshops, and self-study courses that allow you to connect not only with my work on a deeper level, but also with other healthcare humans just like you. So if you want to start humanizing your work and healthcare to a deeper level and do it in community with others, please visit joanchanmd.com and find those options and what fits you and your life today.